Hello, and thank you for listening to In Depth. I'm Jason Futch, and I'm happy to have you here as I talk to Todd Matthews with Namus. Now, in this discussion, Todd and I, we talk about a number of things, especially his beginnings when he was researching a case called The Tent Girl, which he found out about the case through his stepfather, who was in law enforcement at the time. Now, Todd's story is a really cool story because essentially he came from a town in Tennessee and he just evolved into a true crime folk hero. That's my term. Because today, you know, through a lot of programs out there, people will say that the inspiration came from Todd. And I gotta say, I can't argue with that because Todd, to me, is also a hero as well. If it wasn't for him, I don't think that the current version of sleuthing or armchair detective work would be going on right now. In fact, I think Todd is the standard bearer of what true crime sleuthing is all about. And after he had researched Tent Girl, he founded the Doe Network, which is like the largest database for unidentified persons up until Namus came around, and is also a database for missing persons, not just children, but adults as well. So those websites still exist. The Doe Network is still existing. It's doenetwork.org. And when he became involved with Namus, he basically used the inspiration from the Doe Network to help the federal government create this huge database for the missing and unidentified, which is a great tool to use now. And we talk about that in this interview. But before we continue to the interview, I want to let you guys know that today's episode is brought to you by Crime Watchers. CrimeWatchers.net in pursuit of the missing, the unidentified, and justice. Every case that I cover on True Cold Case Files is covered in Crime Watchers. So join in on the conversation. Go to CrimeWatchers.net, create a free account, and just start talking about these cases. It's free and easy to use, and it's also practically ad-free, so you're not going to be worrying about any bugs or any glitches while you're trying to have a conversation about true crime. So the website is crimewatchers.net. Check it out. You won't be disappointed. Create your free account today. With that being said, let's welcome Todd Matthews to In Depth. In this interview, an exclusive for the channel and In Depth, I speak with Todd Matthews, who had a crazy idea of linking missing and unidentified persons cases in a unified system that would be known as the Doe Network, a catalyst for the movement that helped create the National Missing and Unidentified Person System. Todd's work stemmed from a case he stumbled on many years before in a mysterious cold case from Georgetown, Kentucky, in which he assisted in the identification of Tent Girl, Barbara Ann Hackman Taylor. Today, he is the standard bearer for the missing and unidentified in the United States, and the George Hawkins case from Newport, Kentucky is no exception. Todd, I want to thank you for allowing me to interview you today.
Well, it's time to get here, but we're finally on the same page.
So I know.
I'm very happy to interview you.
I know, right? We've been hit and miss this last few times, but we finally got it happening now. So,
well, it does. It wasn't that I didn't want to. Often I was, it was on the weekends often, and we were off on a little boat on the lake, and it was just really hard to have an opportunity to connect. So I'm really glad we got to do this last minute tonight.
So I know, right? I was like, because it's like, which one should I choose, the interview or have a great time on a boat? I think I would choose the boat.
Well, unfortunately, they're costly enough that you use it or you're paying for it anyway, so we're going to use it.
Absolutely. There you go. So, so tell the world about yourself and what you do.
So, you know, I know that for years and still today, I was considered the first cyber sleuth with Tent Girl case. That was the first case that was solved using the internet. It wasn't because I was a brilliant human being. It was just, I just happened to be first, the first one to do it. And that was due in part to, my connection with the Tent Girl case, a body that was found by my father-in-law. You know, that gave me a unique interest in it. So I wasn't trying to be the first cyber sleuth. It just happened during the course of trying to identify her.
So that was your father-in-law who found Tent Girl, huh?
Yes, that's why she was family.
Wow.
I mean, that was, I first heard about it 1997, 32 years ago this week. I heard about the Tent Girl case, which is ironic. That was in October 1987. Mm-hmm. I met my wife at high school. They were new here from Northern Kentucky. This is Middle Tennessee, Livingston, Tennessee. So this is kind of like an anniversary interview.
Wow.
So it was this time period. We were I met her in the high school lunchroom when they came in, her and her two sisters.
Mm-hmm.
My best friend was sitting next to me. I said, "That's the girl I'm going to marry."
Ooh.
And that just sort of rolled out of my mouth. And it's like, where did that come from? I was a senior in high school and wasn't dating anybody at the time. And then I ended up finding Lori in a study hall. She ended up in my study hall later that day. And we immediately started talking. I felt like I knew her for my entire life. I mean,
wow.
You know, and I was just 17 at the time.
Sure.
And she started talking about Tent Girl, and her father had found the body of a woman in 1968. And it seemed so familiar. It, you know, she was familiar. That story sounded like something I'd heard before, but I couldn't have heard it. And, you know, for the next 11 years, you know, we got married within just a few months of graduating high school. Her house had burned here, and her family was going to go back to Northern Kentucky, Southern Indiana. And, you know, she decided she wasn't, and she was going to stay with me. So we sped up her plans to marry.
Mm-hmm.
And, It just kind of happened, you know. But my first search for Tent Girl was not the internet. We didn't have the internet. There wasn't an internet back in 88 is when we got married.
Sure.
So it was like 96, 97 when I got on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
My search before that was very manual. It was driving to a library, going to newspapers, getting old clippings, my father-in-law telling me stories. It was just so many different things. And then once the internet came along, that was the catalyst for change.
Mm-hmm.
So I was already geared up waiting for what's going to help me next.
Yeah.
And you know, when somebody threw the internet down, it's like, that's what I want. You
right?
know, I'll take that. And it ultimately it worked.
Yeah. Because, you know, it's funny, too. You mentioned, like, going to, like, the library, looking up newspaper articles and stuff like that. I still do that. With a number of cases that I follow, and I even was doing that with the Lake City John Doe case, that was my pet case, was the Lake City John Doe case out of Florida, and they identified him a couple years ago, and not only that, they also arrested a suspected killer in that case. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, which is crazy because I spoke to the brother of the John Doe, whose name is Fred Paul Laster, and he told me if it wasn't for web sleuths and the stuff that I was posting on web sleuths, they would have never known that the LCJD was, you know, their brother. So it's crazy because and like going back to the newspapers, I was doing a lot of those newspaper searches, even with the internet, sometimes the internet can only help so much when you're researching these kind of Doe cases.
Well, I always say you can't Google a filing cabinet.
Exactly.
You really can't.
You
so
cannot.
You know, if it's not digitized, and I see cases like that all the time where we'll reach back for decades old cases and they'll say, we never heard about that.
Right.
You know, the current living entity in law enforcement today didn't have the knowledge of the people that were there when that case was put aside, you know, for lack of being able to resolve it. And it's old newspaper articles, maybe even before the current people in law enforcement were born.
Right. Yep. And
so sometimes you got to go old school.
Exactly.
Old school.
But, you know, I always find that part fun, though, you know, because I always like a good challenge, you know, digging through old newspapers or old yearbooks, stuff like that. It just gives me a great challenge. I love it.
Well, I felt like that was really my strong point, was the ability to go back and look through those hard copies and find it more so than the internet. With the internet, it just changed so quickly. When I started trying to find her online, it really wasn't a long time compared to the entire search. So being there for a cyber sleep, it was like, now I have to learn what that means and how to do it again.
So.
You know, and law enforcement were coming from everywhere at the time saying, hey, we got a cold case. Could you solve this one?
So
yeah.
What was the result? So you're introduced to the internet, and you basically put the internet to your use regarding Tent Girl. So what happened that would end up eventually leading up to her identification?
So it was nightly searches, constantly, you know, once I got online, and the internet was not, when people think of it, I didn't have the same internet you have today.
Right.
It was not the same.
Was that dial-up?
I think young people today would look at it and think, wow, that's useless, you know, to say that. I was looking for things. I was looking for sister, mother, daughter, cousin, anything of a missing female relative. That's what I was looking for. And ultimately, well, first of all, I built her a website, Tent Girl. It was a Tent Girl website where I put all of her physical characteristics that I knew of, a photograph of her facial reconstruction, anything that I had. And that was sort of like her wanted poster, be on the lookout type thing. And I thought somebody would see that and come to me and say, oh, that's my sister, that's my mother. And that never happened. But I did keep looking. And I found a family that had posted on Crane and Hibbs. It's sort of the Craigslist of the day.
Yeah.
And I found the sister looking for her. And she said, last known to be alive in Lexington, Kentucky, which is just south of Georgetown, where the Tent Girl was found, December to May 17th, 1968. That wasn't much difference in time.
Sure.
And I contacted her. So luckily, I had the Tent Girl's page built. Because, I mean, you call somebody and say, your sister is not only just missing, she's not alive, and she's an urban legend in Kentucky, and she's been in magazine articles all over the world.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you tell somebody that? So that conversation, luckily, Rosemary Westbrook, the sister, she's Southern, she's from Arkansas, like I am, and I think she trusted my accent, my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, just please listen, go to this website and look at it. I think it'll explain everything. That's my proof.
Yeah.
So I think that was also the first time a website was used to resolve a missing unidentified person's case. You know, it wasn't just me being the first person. That was the first time a website was used successfully, because I had to prove what I was saying to be true.
Sure.
Because it sounded crazy. I know she was probably waiting for me to, you know, where's the punchline? Where's how much money do you want? And I was, and that was what I shouldn't have done. You know, calling the family, cold calling the family is something we tell people you should never, ever, ever do that. You know, reach straight back to the family. You should go through law enforcement. But at that time, where I was in at the time, there was no owner's manual. There was no way to do it.
Yep.
You know, so you know, it was truly the part that was pioneering. I didn't realize we were pioneering. I just had to do the easiest thing I knew how to do.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know. So
I wasn't trying to blaze a new trail. You know, it was like wasn't a trail.
But
you had to do whatever you had to do.
Well, but essentially, you did blaze a trail for people like me and other people out there who, like, especially like the web sleuth community and crime watchers. I mean, if it wasn't for you, I mean, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
Well, and somebody would have done it eventually. I mean, I was fortunate to be the considered the first one to do it. But, I mean, eventually it would be done. And at the time, you know, law enforcement didn't have websites. I mean, the internet was so new, so it wasn't looked as, it was more of an amusement or a pastime for people than anything. So I don't think law enforcement at the time imagined a world that they would be putting things online, that they would be having email addresses and web pages and Facebook pages. You know, we couldn't imagine that at that time. That was 21 years ago that, you know, Tent Girl was resolved now. So we've had 21 years to evolve quite a bit.
Sure.
And, you know, the things that I did back then, law enforcement can do for themselves.
Yeah.
But back in the day, you know, literally after our story was featured on 48 Hours, a police officer showed up on my door. I got calls from law enforcement all over the world.
Wow.
And that's when I had to realize there's got to be more of us. You know, it can't just be me. There's got to be more of us.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that I started meeting ended up, that's how we created No Network. We all contributed a bit to it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually own it now. You know, after all these years, I pay for it. So I own it. But when the Department of Justice called me in 2007 to be on a working group to create something bigger and something, you know, we needed a national database. There should be an entity that takes care of these things, not just volunteers.
Right.
And I don't mean just volunteers in a derogatory way. It's just like the public shouldn't be having to solve this type of cases. There should be a government entity that oversees this, that provides funding for it. So when I had the opportunity to work for NAMIS, well, to develop NAMIS, it was great, you know. But then when I had an opportunity for that to be, this is going to be your job.
So,
you know, I had to step aside from Doe Network.
So was the Doe Network essentially like a brainchild of the NAMIS program?
Doe Network actually was a contributor to, you know, because they saw the success of Doe Network and it was highly publicized in the media.
Yeah.
So I won't say that it was the total sole thing to create NAMIS, but it was something, you know, and that's why they called me. So Kent Girl was something they were interested in, Doe Network success.
Mm-hmm.
Other medical examiners and coroners that were going to extraordinary means to solve their cases, Matt Murphy and Clark County, Nevada, Las Vegas, he was a coroner there. You know, he put some of his bodies online, literally a virtual morgue where you pull back the sheet and you see the actual body. And that was kind of appalling to some at the time.
Sure.
You know, myself included. It's like, oh, you should only use facial reconstructions. You shouldn't actually show up a live dead body. But then it started solving cases. So he was a true pioneer as well.
Yeah.
You know, because I didn't feel comfortable with showing the actual photographs.
Sure.
Even though people would give them to Doe Network, it was like, yeah, but we really should clean it up. It's a little disturbing.
Right, because I know now...
It was reality.
Because I know now Doe Network does offer postmortem photos, but they make you click a link, right? Like, you have to click that link to see it.
Yeah, it's just like we don't want to make it a place where families... Sure. Don't want to go to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't, and you know, and Doe Network is not only services, and it does a different, you know, the end goal is the same as with NAMIS, but it's a totally different process, and it's just different. And Doe Network is international. There are cases in Europe and Canada, Mexico. So I mean, I can't say now that NAMIS exists, Doe Network shouldn't, because it still should.
Oh no, you know what? In fact, I still use Doe Network. In fact, if it wasn't for Doe Network, I wouldn't know how to cover my Canadian cases, because on our on True Cold Case Files, we do one Canadian case per season. Last year, we did the Regina John Doe case from 95.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, very, very horrible story of a young man who lost all hope in the world and committed suicide on the railroad track. But no one heard of that case until we publicized it, and then more people are asking questions about it. And if it wasn't for me just having a 3 a.m. random roll down of a Doe Network page, I'm just like, I would have never found out. So while we're on the Doe Network, what is the current success rate for Doe Network now? Because I know it's been
beneficial. I know there's over 80 cases that we contributed to, and we developed the term of assisted. Like, is this something Doe Network resolved, or did we just provide a piece of the puzzle and assist? And we use something very similar in NAMIS as well now. Like, what role did NAMIS play in this resolution when we try to archive a case? And, you know, we do need to know that to actually hone our services so that we're providing the right type of services. So a lot of the things I learned at Doe Network are working, developing, were things that the challenges that I brought to NAMIS. Like, here's what I encountered in Doe Network, and this is how we fixed it. And, you know, and that was part of the working group, which is 2 years for me.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the things that I could contribute. You know, there were scientists, PhDs, I mean, people that were brilliant. And I thought, what am I going to give them? I had knowledge of the internet that they did not yet have. That was the thing. So, and I had some experience with solving a case using that type of technology.
Sure.
So I was able to say, okay, here's a wall that I hit, and here's a way around it.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able, and they did heed my advice, and in fact asked me to stay and be, you know, part of the management structure later. You know, I wasn't trained for communications, outreach, that type of thing. I learned it on the fly with Tent Girl and Anto Network.
Nice. And you were, you when they called you in to do the NamUs program, what was your role? Was it your role basically was just to set it up, just to get the thing rolling and maybe see?
Well, working group. Working group was a pitch. You know, you were all pitching ideas and this is my problem and this is my problem. And, you know, some of the things they were struggling with, the internet, not just me, but the internet provided the solution, you know, and since a lot of them wasn't really using the internet at the time, you know, some of the challenges that I overcome with Tent Girl, you know, several years in by then, I was nearly 10 years in by then with the resolution of the Tent Girl. 2007 is when they called me, so that was a good 9 years.
Wow.
And, you know, after the idea of Tent Girl, so I had a lot of experience under my belt with Doe Network at that time, and I think, what if this happens? And I thought, oh, it did happen, and this is what we did to fix it.
Yeah.
Well, what about this? Well, yeah, we did that, and I didn't know I was going to be a really valuable contributor to them. You know, I thought I was going to be somebody they're going to pat me on the head and say, good job for Tent Girl, go home. And but it wasn't. You know, I did have something I could share with them. Unfortunately, now most law enforcement agencies are so good at it. Me back in that day, I wouldn't have been very valuable to them.
Yeah. And you, and so you're, you, but now you're kind of like overseeing NamUs now. Am I, is that correct?
Well, I'm one of the directors of NamUs. We have four directors. Okay. BJ Spommer is our executive director, and she was part of the working group as well. So we've known each other for years. Mm-hmm. She's a background from National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and work very closely together. And we have Tiffany Mao, and she's our Victim Services Unit Director. Wonderful lady. And, she's going to help us build a unit where we can actually work with families and try to find out what do they need. Can we pay for an exhumation after an identification for reunification? That's a mouthful there. You know, so we're looking at cases like that. And luckily, over my past 20-some-odd years, I know a lot of cases that our Victim Services Unit could contribute to very well.
Yeah.
And Lindley Dungan, she is our IT director with NamUs, so she's helped us work on NamUs 2.0, the reboot of NamUs, you know, as our technology evolves, making it work faster, stronger, smarter.
I love the new NamUs. I love the new NamUs.
Well, not everybody does, you know. I know that. I mean, it's changed. And I think it's because people don't like change. It's vastly improved.
Sure.
But it's different. So you'll have people that'll say, "Well, I don't like it this, or I don't like that."
I think one of the biggest things about it is now the exclusions are not open, like really open anymore, unless you get an account with NamUs. I think of the complaints that I've heard, I think that's the biggest one, was the exclusion list not being available to the general public if they did not have a NamUs account.
Well, and I think that's just accountability. You know, there's certain things we had to do. There's some data that we don't share publicly. Dental DNA and fingerprint status.
Yeah. Oh,
that
sure.
That could be considered PPI, you know, private information.
Yeah.
And, you know, we realized that over the years that maybe some of that has to be kind of behind the scenes with law enforcement. You know, they have to be our primary user. We have to make sure law enforcement uses the system, and the system is capable of creating suggested matches. Now, law enforcement can go in, enter their missing person or their unidentified. The system itself has some geography, chronology, physical characteristics. They can say, here are some cases that could potentially be, you know, the thing the cyber sleuth does. Here are some possibilities for you. They can then exclude. That's how they start the exclusion process, is when they look at it and they can compare dental, DNA, or fingerprints, whichever is available, all that's available, and they can issue an exclusion so that the public doesn't have to make that same suggestion again.
Right.
We might not be able to tell you. And back in the day with Doe Network, if somebody told me this is an exclusion, I didn't ask them why. I took their word for it. I didn't say, was it dental, DNA, fingerprints? If they told me, they told me. If they didn't, they didn't. You know, we just took their word for it. Okay, we'll mark it off our list.
Yep.
And we did. So, and that's the same principle we have to work by today. You know, we're not going to be able to tell you the investigative case details. But, and I did get involved with Tent Girl in a way that I got to go behind the curtain with Tent Curl. I didn't know that I could. I just kind of got swept behind it, and I got to see things that, you know, we might not always be able to share with the general public. Even if they were part of the resolution, there's still a homicide investigation. There's still so many things that, that you can't risk. And Tent Curl, we just didn't know any better at the time. It was the first time it had ever been done. We made mistakes.
Yeah.
But we also blazed trail.
Yeah, and it's like with, like, we were going back to those newspaper articles we were talking about earlier. I noticed in some, like, older newspapers, like from the 70s and so on, sometimes they offer too much information on a case. And then fast forward to today's world, that's considered privileged information. And, like, me living here in Oregon, where our forensic anthropologist Dr. Nikki Vance is doing a hell of a good job out here.
And I know Nikki Vance, and she is doing a great job.
Oh yeah.
She's awesome.
I you know, it's funny because I tried to reach out to her. In fact, I wanted to do an interview with her on In Depth, but obviously because of her position, she really can't. But but we've been researching the Findlay Creek Jane Doe case, and really all we've had was the newspaper clippings. Now, I brought that up to Dr. Vance, and she told me, okay, yes, we knew that the Findlay Creek Jane Doe was strangled with a radio cord, but we did not want to include that in the NamUs profile because that's what we considered privileged information. That's not something we should be putting in NamUs, you know. Because this is a murder investigation and we don't want to, you know, mess it up.
Well, and sometimes if law enforcement feel comfortable enough to share certain bits of information, if they don't have the data field to enter it in the public, they can also mention the circumstances. So if it's like, it's a known fact that this person was shot.
Right.
You know, they can put that in the circumstances if that's what they want. I mean, it's not the deny information, is to protect the information.
Sure, yeah, and she and Dr. Vance, because when I brought up those newspaper clippings, she wasn't like, oh my God, you found out, you know, like that. But she was like, you know, yeah, we were aware of this already, but we just can't. We're just not at liberty to put that out in the open just yet, you know. So I was like, all right, I'll take her word for it. But I know she's got a big issue here in Oregon right now where, I guess, back then and also up to about maybe the early 2000s, the medical examiner's office here had this practice of cremating human remains if they persisted in being unidentified. So she's got a big old problem here where she doesn't have DNA for a good number of her does, which that presents some big challenges, don't you think?
It does, and it's not uncommon. You know, it was just practice in the day, and we have to live with it. I mean, there's things that happen that were common practice, and we didn't know any better. And I guarantee you, 20 years from now, something we're doing now as standard practice is going to be like, wow, if they hadn't have done that, we might have been able to do this.
Right.
So it's just growing pains. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but there's also dental records, you know, and they had to focus on dental and fingerprints at the time.
Oh yeah.
So the soft tissue, you had fingerprints and possibly dental records. If it's skeletal, you had dental records.
Right. And that's basically what she's been working with out here in Oregon is dental records, as well as the medical examiner in Clark County, Washington. Her name is Nikki as well, Nikki Costa. But, you know, we continue to talk about unidentified human remains and NamUs and DOE Network. But NamUs also services the missing as well.
Yes.
Now, on occasion...
Well, DOE Network does too.
Oh, well, yes. Yeah,
they focus mostly on unidentified.
Right. And so how often is it that you get hit with those missing persons cases?
Oh, that's we have more missing persons than unidentified, I think, in the system.
Wow. That's very interesting because I know...
Or they're very close. They're very close to the same number.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them rise up and go back and forth above each other, but they're very close. And that doesn't mean all those pieces are going to fit together.
You know,
there was a survey several years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, that said they thought there'd be 40,000 unidentified remains in the United States. And that could be true. You know, we don't have half that many, you know, just yet. But it's constantly that we're seeing something that is in hard copy format, old cases that I can't Google search. So just because I Google search it on my computer and I don't find anything, I can't say that's not true.
Right.
You know, because it might be a hard copy. And I've done that in my own community. There were two cases that I knew about because I saw an autopsy report, hard copy, and we uploaded them to NAMIS. Call local officials and they say, we don't know what you're talking about. And then you go to the library or the newspaper office and you go back to that time period in their archives. And it's like, here it is. And then I have everything I need. And a lot of times they were very forthcoming in those news articles. You know, I get clothing descriptions, a lot of different descriptions that might not be an autopsy report. You see, so they're not going to describe certain things in an autopsy report that might have been something visually law enforcement saw at the time. So that's enhancement for that article. So that's something that the volunteer community could go back and look at cases. You know, if you heard there was a case that was resolved or a body that was found or a missing person from long ago and you can't find it online, go to the newspaper office. You might find a hard copy that I can't get to.
There you go. There's 50
states out there, you know.
Yeah, and lots of rural communities too, especially with law enforcement who might not have the knowledge or the funding or the technology to even do anything like that. So, you know, Mayberry.
Well, I always say you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly.
and that's the truth. You know, I'm not going to know to look. I've heard of cases recently in my own community that I'd never heard of before, that people have approached me and said, hey, did you know this? And it's like, no, I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
And then they have hard copy proof. It's like, wow. I've never heard of that. Nobody ever told me that. It was at my back door.
Yeah.
And then you research it and, you know, turns out I think that's going to be a lot of these small communities that are going to have the same findings.
Sure. And I agree with that because, I mean, like, and especially in your region too, you know, like Kentucky and Tennessee, you've got a lot of missing people out there, human remains out there that haven't been identified. In fact, I am covering two cases on this season in Kentucky. One case is the Kenneth Saunders case out of Knox County, which he suddenly disappeared in really suspicious circumstances. And I didn't know about that case until my girlfriend, who's from Knox County, told me about it. And I looked it up and then I ended up connecting with his wife and we've been exchanging information and I was like, well, look, you know, do you know Todd Matthews? She was like, I don't, but is this somebody I should know? I was like, you should get to know him very well. So I told her to go hit you up, but she's been battling chemotherapy, bless her heart. And so hopefully she'll get around to it. But another case, though, that really, really, really struck my interest and one of the reasons why I included it in season two of True Cold Case Files is the circumstances involving the disappearance of George Hawkins, a constable out of Newport.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when did you first hear about that case? Huh? The Eggman, yes.
The Eggman.
So when did you first hear about that case?
Well, actually, in NAMIS, I got more intimately involved and I knew more about it, but that's something that you kind of hear that happens in the community. So it had popped up over the years. So before NAMIS, I heard of that case, but I wasn't really involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And once KSP, Kentucky State Police, you know, really grabbed hold of that case and they wanted to do a lot of work, you know, they got it into NAMIS, they did this, they did that. There was a lot of things that we didn't have. George Hawkins has been gone for many years. His parents are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all I knew was his granddaughters.
Yep. And
his two daughters.
And for those of you who jumped straight to this interview, because I know, you know, us having Todd Matthews on can be pretty exciting. So if you jump straight to the interview before listening to the podcast on Constable Hawkins, I just want to offer a brief description of this case. George Hawkins was last seen on April 3rd of 1961 in Newport, Kentucky. He resided in Persimmon Grove, which I assume is outside of Newport. And he was employed as a law enforcement officer, a.k.a. a constable. And he also ran a small general store. So on the day of his disappearance, Hawkins had fixed his daughter's breakfast and saw her off to work, said goodbye to his wife, and left in his tan two-tone 1959 Plymouth Fury station wagon. And I just wanted to just give them a quick snippet of that. But George Hawkins had also been involved in so-called criminal activity, perhaps being involved with the local mafia at the time, and that which investigators believe may have led to his disappearance. Now, who was the mafia? What was the mafia all about? I mean, the last thing you would even think about is the mafia in Kentucky. Come on now.
Well, that was northern Kentucky, so it was in the suburbs of Cincinnati.
Ah.
So see, it's not so strange to think about. And being in that area, it's really a very urban area.
Yeah.
Where you're speaking of, even back in the day, there was a lot of people there in Cincinnati, in the shadow of Cincinnati. That was incredible. And actually, the Cincinnati airport is in Kentucky.
Yeah, that's what I was told.
A lot of people think about that, but it is.
Yeah, Jessica told me that.
It's in Kentucky.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's just like me being from Florida, I always think of Kentucky as just being a big old southern state, but I also forget all of the borders that it encompasses, like in Missouri and Cincinnati and like, you know, all these places, Indiana. And
in southern, you know, there's the Nashville, Fort Campbell region, which just straddles the Kentucky border. I mean, that's all part of one big, huge, community, all the way through Bowling Green. Bowling Green's not that far. I'm right on the Tennessee-Kentucky border, so I don't really think of going to a different state. I'm just going to Bowling Green or Nashville or Lexington or Chattanooga. I don't really see it as two separate states. It's just what's in my area.
Sure,
my wife's from Kentucky and I'm from Tennessee, so we're comfortable in both places.
Yeah, it's like here in Oregon where I live in Portland area, and it's just like because we have a town north of here called Vancouver, Washington. It's in Washington State, and I'm just like, hey, I'm just going over to Vancouver for a little bit. However, if I tell that to a stranger who's never been here before, they're going to think I'm out of my mind because I'm going to Canada. I'm like, no, idiot.
I'm just going to Vancouver again.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what was Constable Hawkins known for? They call him the Eggman. Could you elaborate more on that?
Well, you might have to help me out a little bit, and I think Charlie Project probably skimmed that data somewhere else because it's out there. They'll just harvest data and throw it on their website. But apparently, you would have to buy a very expensive egg from him, and something to do with the county taxes and that type of thing. So your illegal business might be overlooked if you'd purchase this very expensive egg. And you just bought an egg. You know, what you paid for it was one thing, you know. And you could be overlooked for some kind of scrutiny. You know, he was a constable. So, we're going to look the other way if you buy an egg. That was the story, you know.
Gotcha.
So, and then he disappears. And, you know, apparently somebody wasn't happy with the egg, you're thinking. So, what happened was we didn't have a lot of information on him, you know. If you have DNA, a man cannot pass down mitochondrial DNA to his daughters, to any of his children. Mitochondrial DNA is not there. You can't pass it down. So we have two daughters, and, they can give a DNA sample, but it's not going to give mito, which might be very necessary if certain cases are degraded in a certain way. So they wanted to make sure that they was able to get a mito sample, and the only way to get a mito sample from him was from his own mother,
sure,
which had passed away many years before. The granddaughters of his mother gave permission for local law enforcement, KSB, to actually exhume her body to get a bone sample so that mitochondrial DNA could be developed from that.
Sure.
And that's what happened.
Yeah.
And I remember that day. That was the day when they done that, and I met the granddaughters and, got to see them. It was an interesting thing, and I think they did a great thing to allow that.
Yeah.
But it gave them hope. It gave them hope that, we might have enough, even after they're gone. If they don't live to see the resolution of it, they're getting up in years themselves. And they knew that they contributed to something that could resolve that case at some point in time.
Sure.
They gave a piece of it. So if that case is resolved, I have to say those granddaughters, they participated.
And speaking of the granddaughters, they have a little bit of fear about this whole situation. They don't really speak much about the case in public because of possible retaliation, right?
Well, and I don't think there's that great a fear now because that type of business is long gone. A lot of that sure. is based on gambling, prohibition, a lot of that stuff's long gone.
But
long forgotten. And a lot of the people that, anybody that would have been involved in his homicide are long gone.
Yeah, sure. Now.
Nobody left to be prosecuted for this. But still, closure, being able to find a resolution for that case and actually put a name on a stone, that's what needs to happen, at some point in time. So, we witness a lot of things. A lot of times, we might not be able to do something, but we witness a great many things. Mm-hmm. And that helps us to know what to do next. How could we have done this better? How can we make the family be more comfortable? How could we have made the law enforcement more efficient? Mm-hmm. Anything that we can do. So it's good to see these.
So was there any ties to the gambling, the mafia families in the Northeast? Was there any ties to Gambino or anything like that?
That I don't really know. I know there's probably a lot of theories, a lot of armchair theories too.
Sure.
I'm sure with that.
Yeah,
but I think a lot of that stuff, proving it's going to be so far away.
Right.
I think our mission is going to be simply not to find out how and why. It's more who.
Yeah.
Would be for him.
Because I would think.
My mind as a person that's worked on cases like this, like Tinker, who, what, when, where, why, and how.
Yep.
But the job at Namus is, we're going to provide you who. The rest of it's your job.
Right, there you go, and that's the way it should go, honestly.
There's a time where you have to ride off in the sunset, whether you're Namus or a volunteer, whatever. You do what you have to do, or you contribute what you have or what you know, and then you have to say off to the next case, because
right.
our job is specifically missing and unidentified and putting names with faces, names with missing and unidentified, connecting them together. That's our thing. Honestly, there's not enough time to sit there and see things through fruition. I've been fortunate in cases like Tent Girl and Eggman, and because I live here, you're fortunate enough to be still somewhat in the loop with knowing what's happening next, or you read it in the newspaper and people will call you back for how did Namus help this case, and things like that. But often I really don't know exactly what they do next. Unless they ask for more help or something, we just provide them with the information to make the identification. We don't make identifications. We provide them with information that allows them to. And then off to the next case, because that's our job.
Right.
Off to the next case. So, and it's hard. It is really hard. A cyber sleuth out there should not envy me doing what I have to do, because a lot of times it's like leaving. You're watching a television show and you're leaving in the last 10 minutes. It's like, I really would like to see what happens after this commercial, but you don't have time for that. I have to move on. There's emergent cases that are constantly going on. So you don't always have time to sit and watch it to the final act. You slip out the back door and let history take its course.
There you go. Now, let's see here. Let's see. It's not, George Hawkins had disappeared in 1961. So almost 20 years later, a skull was found along the Ohio River in Carroll County, 1980, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the story behind that?
And that's not something that happens every day. There's not something that happens every day to find a body. My sister-in-law lives in Carroll County, or works in Carroll County, Kentucky. My wife, Lori's sister, Lena, she works for a dental office there. And that's not something, even today, that happens very often to find that. I'm very familiar with the area. So,
sure.
Of course, the first assumption was that could be connected to him.
Right. Because, I would have, outside looking in, that reconstruction, it was just like looking at a photo, like the photographs of Mr. Hawkins. It looked just like Mr. Hawkins. So what happened? What was the end result of that? Because I know that they did a test on the skull, but I don't know what the result was. What had happened?
It is still incomplete. I don't have an answer for you yet.
Really?
I mean, it's all, you know, DNA, remains that were in water, mitochondrial, needing other people's DNA to actually get that. It's a very complicated process.
Wow.
So, and, I don't peek in the window. I just wait for the note that comes out, and then we react to it. We do what we have to do with it. And, I know as soon as, Detective Samu in Northern Kentucky with KSPs, he's leading up that case. When he gets something that indicates that there's some kind of identification, we'll be hearing from him.
Wow.
And we'll have to help him organize, okay, here's how we need to put this together. Do we need to announce this? Can I help you announce this? What kind of interviews are going to be as a result of this? And, you know, first and foremost, notifying the remaining family with what they decide. And that guy is all over things. Andre Samu, the detective at KSP, you probably won't find a more dedicated person that's trying to resolve these missing and unidentified persons cases in Kentucky, in his area of Kentucky, the northern area. I mean, I think Kentucky has the best on it. And the medical examiner in Kentucky is one of the best out there. And I'm not saying that's because it's the first one that I ran into during my work. I mean, I feel like they're so dedicated to it. I don't have to, you know, I don't feel like we have to ask them to do something. They're asking us to help them do something.
Sure.
You know, so it's wonderful. They're very proactive, I'll say that.
Wow. So
I enjoyed working with them.
Well, that's good. Because, I mean, it sounds like, it does sound like the Kentucky State Police are taking these John and Jane Doe cases seriously, especially after, like, the recent developments, like with the woman in the fridge in Knox County. You guys were on that. Like, I just remember, and that was a DNA Doe Project case, right? Or was that that was Namus, right?
Yes, and in that case, and, you know, you can't help for it to be personal to you if you live in that area. I mean, cases within a couple of hundred miles of me that I knew about before Namus came along, that I knew about before I started working for even developing Doe Network. These were the cases that I saw in the newspaper when I didn't have anything to do with anything like that. So they're in my living memory as witnessing it in my community, you know, in my larger community. So those cases can't help but be a little special to you. You know, we have to help with all the cases across the United States. But, you know, when something's right behind you or in your backyard, you know, you kind of look just like anybody would look. You know, if it's right there in your backyard, it's like, that's within my arm's reach.
Right, exactly.
Pay attention to that a little more.
Yeah.
But cases in Oregon are just as important. You know, I'm going to spend as much time working on a case in Oregon as needed as I would anywhere else in the country. But when you're looking in your personal space, you're going to know those cases just a little better if it's right there in your personal space.
And that was like one of the reasons why I follow the Fly Creek case real close, because it happened. It may not have happened in Oregon, but it happened right across the river. But going back to George Hawkins' case, there's definitely a chance he could be identified, huh?
We're hopeful, you know. To reverse the temptation of looking and asking questions constantly, you know, I just have to I might seem like a very patient person. I'm not. You know, I'm constantly. But I've got so many cases like that we're waiting on. We're just waiting on just hundreds of cases that I can distract myself enough with all of these doing my job.
Yep.
And, you know, we're looking at anniversary dates on John and Jane Doe's, opportunities to bring a case up and, you know, get it back in the media or get it in the media for the first time since we've had digital media. That allows me not to sit there and think about how long is it going to be for this case.
Sure.
You know, there's so many cases that I'm waiting on, you know, and to a tent girl, the anxiety of waiting for that was just unbearing. And now I can distract myself with many cases and just do what I have to do.
There you go.
So I don't even count the time. I can't even tell you how long it's been since that body's been exhumed, you know, even though, I passed through the area at the time, you know, and witnessed many things.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even tell you the date.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. In the last couple of years, we've seen the emergence of forensic genealogy. Now we're talking about Barbara Rae Venter and the girls over at DNA Doe Project. How? What? What's your take on it? Because I know that's a completely different area from NamUs, like DNA Doe Project, where, in fact, as of this recording, they just identified the Pillar Point John Doe, or Pillar Point Doe.
I think it's very promising. I think it's limited. I don't want people to do that instead of doing the standard CODIS. And you know what law enforcement realized? Don't do that first. Do our national database, our national CODIS database first. Make sure that you've done that, because that's going to be more inclusive, and it's more expensive, as far as that goes right now. I think it's just like I said, when I brought the internet, when I went to law enforcement, say the internet can solve a lot of your crimes per the Tent Girl, they gave me a lot of looks. Like, well, and it had to be developed, it took many years, from 1998 to 2007 and 9, when we developed the NamUs database, it took time to develop it into a point that law enforcement could securely use it. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's going to be the same with the Doe DNA project. We're going to have to figure out, where does this fit into things, and how are we going to manage it, and mm-hmm. how are we going to pay for it?
Sure.
How are we going to distribute it? So, to me, it's just another, it's another emergent technology that we have to figure out, where does it fit into the big scheme of things. So I'm glad it's here. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like it's competition at all. It just, there's a lot of work it needs to spend. There's a lot of legal issues where people have donated their DNA for a family tree, and now they're involved in a homicide. Or a family member is. That could have caused people not to do those family DNA trees, because they thought, well, I have privacy issues here. So there's a lot of legal things we have to think about, too, before we completely exploit something like that. So, and I'm saying we, not me. There's going to be other people looking at that. I guess that our government, our Department of Justice, has to look at, like, how can we effectively use this and not violate people's rights?
Right.
We're going to have to give them a way to opt out. And if people opt out, are we going to lose that piece of data that we're looking for in the first place? So I think it's going to work itself out. It just has to keep going. And the more there's an ID, the more relevant it becomes. Nobody wanted to talk to me before the ID of the Tent Girl. After that, they all wanted to talk to me. So I think this is one of the same type of things.
Yeah. And, I personally think it's like groundbreaking technology, especially with the fact that, Margaret Press and Colleen Fitzpatrick, they're working on cases that happened way before both you and I were born. Like for instance, recently, earlier this year, Annie Doe, right here in Oregon, Josephine mm-hmm. County Jane mm-hmm. Doe, identified as Annie Lehman after 40 some odd years. And, and I think that was one of those cases right after yours that made the web sleuth forums, and everyone had their theories, their, possible matches, but none of them came close to until DNA Doe Project found that missing link, so to speak.
Yeah. And, well, it developed an investigative lead that was mm-hmm. able to be used to its fullest potential, so that's good. So, anything like that's an emerging technology, the government's going to watch that and figure out exactly how it can be developed and used, just like they did with me. At some point in time, I was a rising upstart that done something I wasn't supposed to do with the technology that wasn't invented to do that. And then ultimately, it was developed into something, and I finally become part of the process. And now other people do it far better than I would ever do it. It was just somebody had to be the first person to walk through the door, and I was fortunate enough that it was me. And now we do it so much better now.
Someone's got to be first. So, I completely agree with that. So ever since this. So, and I'm just going to wrap this up with Hawkins. Ever since those leads, the exhumation of the Carol, of the mother getting the DNA out, has there been any further fresh leads other than what we know right now?
I can't recall any right offhand.
Okay.
I think Detective Samu has had a lot of theories in his mind already, and we leave him with that unless he asks us for help.
Yep.
I think he knows exactly what he's looking for, and he's a brilliant man.
Sure.
I can't say enough about him. I've met him a couple of times, two or three times in person, and well trained with KSV, I don't think you could get anybody that cares. If you have a missing person and you're under his watch, you are in good hands.
Good.
Because he is going to do everything he can to make sure it works out right. He is totally dedicated. And a lot of people are. I think our law enforcement are sometimes overlooked by the public. You know, we have a lot of admiration for the military, but, you know, law enforcement's kind of like our military here on the ground in the United States. They are. You know, they're on the front line here in our home battles. You know, we have the opioid crisis. We have so many different things they're battling. They're our troops. They're our domestic troops. They are.
I agree.
I don't think people realize that at times. You know, you get to go home at night and you have to lose your that, but you still have to put on that bulletproof vest and go out and, you know, you're risking your life when you get in that car. Even in a small town, you're still risking your life when you get in that car. You put on that vest, you strap on that badge. You are risking your life every day. And you don't get paid enough to do that. You know, you really can't. So I have a great appreciation for what they do, from the tiniest thing to the biggest thing that they do.
Sure.
We got to respect that. So, and we got to give them, and that's what we want to do. That's what NAVIS is about. We got to give them the tools and the inspiration to do what they have to do with resolving these cases. A great many of the John and Jane Doe cases are homicides.
Sure. Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, so, I mean, there's a lot more to the story. So we want to do everything we can do to help them do their job to its fullest potential. Sure. You know, we want to make at least some part of their job as easy as we possibly can, and we have staff dedicated to that. And the staff is growing. You know, I remember our staff was just a handful of people, and it grew more and more, you know, so I think we're around 30 now, that, you know, from everything from IT to the forensic services, to the case management, to the communications, and overall management of the system. You know, there's a lot of people involved in it now, and it's going to grow. You know, our mission is to grow our divisions and do a better service. 9 states now require state law. By state law, require the use of NAMIS. Most recently, North Carolina joined that. October 1st, it became mandatory in North Carolina. If you're missing or unidentified, at some point that's designated in the law, you must go into NAMIS. And that's good.
That's good.
So we have 41 more states, you know, and I don't want to rush it too much because we have to be able to grow and accommodate having, you know, more states that are bringing more volume to us. So it's like drinking from a fire hose. You be careful. You know, it's like, okay, let's not do all 41 tomorrow, but let's be looking at them and deciding how that we can fit them in, because we're going to have to add a state, accommodate. And so there are several states that are considering state law, which is good.
Yeah.
The national effort to pass a state law, they helped find the missing act, the Billy Smolinski law from Connecticut, you know, 10 years ago, it didn't pass at the national level to require NAMIS usage. But we have been able to see states pass it at the state level because they can tweak it to fit their state. Kentucky has coroners. Tennessee uses a regional forensic center instead of a state medical examiner and coroners.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Every state has a different system. So by tweaking that wording to fit that state, the state's able to pass it and accept it and not feel like it's something that the government has just placed upon them. They've developed it themselves and imposed it and implemented it and voted on it. So they've embraced it. In Tennessee, it passed unanimously. I was there when we voted on it.
Nice.
When the state voted on it, I was in the Tennessee House chamber when they voted on that, and I saw those green lights going on the board above us, and not one representative voted against it. You know, that was an amazing thing to see. That's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And I remember one of the state representatives stood up and he pointed at me. He said, "Young man," he said, "you've helped pass state law in Tennessee," which is where I live, you know. And you know, that was just emotionally like,
sure,
wow.
Yeah,
you know, because
right.
What I did was testify. You know, I had to testify.
Yeah.
So if, you know, I do go before the committee and say, "How much is this going to cost?" It costs you nothing. Where does the money come from? It comes from, you know, the National Institute of Justice. What office services do you offer? They offer this. You know, so, I mean, it was just going through that process of explaining what the process was. And when they all voted unanimously, it was like, wow, you know, this is it. Tennessee was the second state that passed the state law. New York was first, but New York passed it on unidentified first. Unidentified cases must go into NAMIS. And then after Tennessee passed it based on both missing and unidentified, New York came in and did an amendment that required missing persons to be added to their law. So it was just kind of crazy. So we have model legislation in Tennessee that, we've handed to other states. If somebody says, hey, we want to do this in Arkansas, well, here's what we did in Tennessee, if it helps you at all. This is what Tennessee did.
Sure.
So, and that's happened a lot. So now we've got up to 9 states, and every state, kind of does a little better job, because they see the pitfalls, and they'll ask, what's the holdup? And we can tell, well, this happened and this, so, and we can tell them how to get around those obstacles. Just kind of like I did when I went to that should contributor to develop and name it. But these are the walls I hit, walls that you didn't know existed, from a technology standpoint. And it's the same as state law. We can say, here's the mistakes we made. Don't make the same mistake.
So is there a plan to possibly integrate NamUs with databases for the RCMP, like to work with Canadian law enforcement possibly?
We have Canadian friends, and they've been here. I've actually seen them in different working groups and conventions. So we do have a Canadian counterpart.
Nice.
And I've met my Canadian counterpart at different times. There's different people, but we're divided up a little differently. We're looking over each other, so we are in communication with our Canadian counterpart. They do have a database. It's not quite like NamUs.
No, it's not.
A little different, but there is a missing and unidentified persons database with our RCMP. Mm-hmm. There is.
Yeah, I saw that, and I noticed it's a little more just very simplistic compared to NamUs, where you can do a lot of much thorough searching on NamUs versus the Canadian database. But basically the Canadian database, from what I've seen, is just more general. Kind of like if you were looking up a missing person on missingkids.org, like that one. That's what it reminded me a little bit of. But I like the fact that they're also stepping up and they want to work with you guys, because I honestly think that some particular cases, like the Sumter Does, a lot of people are tying them to Canadians for some reason. Like, they think they're Canadians. So I would think, I guess if NamUs had a database for DNA, like with Canadian cases, maybe perhaps, a swift process, if you will.
Well, of course, we're going to be, I've worked often with RCMP, and I know the staff has as well. The regional program specialists have worked a lot with the Canadian government, and easy, great people. I think they've got the same heart and mission that we have. So that's something, because we share that open border, and there's going to be a lot of crossover there. And I think they're as committed to it as we are.
Yeah.
But, I mean, NamUs, I have to say, NamUs is the flagship like no other. I mean, I've spent the last, since 2007, so the last 12 years of my life has been dedicated to the development and making NamUs be the best that it can be. I left Doe Network aside. I had to step away and let the volunteers, we have volunteers, people running it right now, So I couldn't be in the day-to-day and work in this position. I couldn't. So, you have to step aside, but, I was willing to step aside and give these years to this process, these past 12 years. I'll be 50 next year, and it was a commitment here on this end too, to say, okay, I'm going to step away from personal development and work on a government development of a database, And a lot of people have done that. A lot of people have switched careers. They've jumped ship and went here. We have staffers that were former coroners. We have staffers that were had different roles. Not that they necessarily retired from, but they left because they had something that NamUs needed, and we had an opportunity to bring them on board. Well, they still have many, many years to give and, use their skills and bring it to it. I mean, it's easy enough. We don't want to find people and just create roles. It's just like, wow. When we're interviewing people, that person has exactly what we need, to help hone something that's just been a little bump in the road. We're able to do that. And we share data with each other. We share experiences. We have many, many years of experience on several different forensic fronts in NamUs. And that's the tool. That's the ticket.
Sure.
To make it work is to have people like, I know who's my go-to for this and who's my go-to for that, if we need to talk about things in NamUs.
Sure. And bring it home. So you're talking about volunteers, and at mm-hmm. Doe Network. Now, are there volunteer opportunities currently at Doe Network, and is there any type of volunteer work for NamUs?
Well, there's always a volunteer opportunity at Doe Network. You know, they'll take submission forms for people, you know, mm-hmm. offer to be a volunteer, and then they have to close it because we get so many. It's a job to go through the volunteer applications. But to me, I'm telling people this, share the stories. If you see them on Facebook, share those stories, make sure that people see them, because if something's written in the news, we need to make sure that people see those stories. Missing unidentified state law. You know, if your state hasn't passed state law, and there's Tennessee, New York, Tennessee, Michigan, Illinois, Arkansas, New Mexico, West Virginia, North Carolina have all passed state laws to require the use of NamUs. There's 41 other states out there. You know, do your research into that. And if you know somebody, in New York, it was actually an author, Jan Burke, that actually reached out to an assemblyman in the New York legislature and said, hey, there ought to be a law.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, you know, and eventually there was a law. You know, that's kind of what kicked this off. We all kind of knew it's just like, how do we do this? And, you know, Jan Burke might have called to a personal friend, and it's like, wow, it changed things. So even if we can't pass state law immediately in a state, at least the conversation started and the state representatives are aware of NamUs. Sure. Like, all 50 states will not pass a state law. I know that.
No.
But if they're doing the job and they don't need to pass a state law, why would we pass it? Why would we go through the process of passing a law if they're already doing it?
Sure.
So yeah. That's what the volunteers can do. They can look at, how are we effectively using NamUs, and can I do anything? You know, it's like, you don't have to be the person that does the investigation. You can do things that creates processes that eliminate that need.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right now, my job is to make my job not necessary. I would like to not have a job because we don't have a problem.
Yeah.
I found out over the past 12 years, that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah.
I have a feeling I'm going to retire from this job, and the job's still going to need to be done. I know that. That's not going to stop me from trying, but I realize that there's no overnight fix. It's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of work. It's ongoing work.
Sure.
And I had to be okay with that. I remember when I first started doing this, my wife said, you want to change the world? And I was like, yeah, I do. I do want to change the world. And it's like, it's going to take a while.
Yeah,
it's going to take a little while.
So how does your wife feel about your work doing missing and unidentified persons cases? How does she feel about it?
Well, now that it's my job to do it, and then it, you know, you eventually leave it at night and you go do normal activities. See, when I was doing it voluntarily, I wasn't a volunteer with Tent Girl. That was more personal.
Yeah.
She felt I was taking away from personal time to do something for somebody else.
Sure.
Even though there wasn't anybody specific other than a person. It's like, but now she realizes this is my 9 to 5 and sometimes 9 to 10 and you know, sometimes it's longer than that. I think it's our responsibility, you know, from what I've learned and what I've experienced. If I don't pass it on, that's my immortality. You know, what I pass along, if I share what I've learned and I show you how to avoid the things that have rocked my world and the walls that I've hit, and I tell you how not to hit them, you're going to fly higher, you're going to fly stronger. And that's what I want people to do.
Sure.
My job is to allow the next generation to do better than we did this generation.
Oh,
that's what it's about. You know, we're evolving. You know, I want somebody to beat me. I want somebody to beat the record.
Well, I
want somebody to eliminate the need.
I completely agree with that, because, I mean, yeah, at some point, you know, the ball has to keep rolling, you know. I completely mm-hmm. agree with that. Any final thoughts or anything you want to share with our listeners before we say goodbye?
Well, just don't get overzealous. This is not a glamorous thing. You know, I know you might see my name in the news media very often. And you know, this is not a glamorous thing. Like, usually it's under a lot of pressure. I'm having to, you know, really concentrate on every word that I say, you know, trying to do these news articles. I have to make sure that I'm doing the best possible job for everybody involved. So it's nothing that's going to happen overnight. I'm in it now, 1987 to 2019 deep.
Mm.
And we still got a lot of work to do, but at least I'm seeing progress. So I'm happy to just be a foundational stone at some point in time. You know, there's a point in time that I have to say, you know what, I've done all I can do and I'm satisfied with what I've done.
Sure.
You know, I did what I could. you know, and I think other people think it too, you know, there's not going to be a lot more of these groundbreaking things with, you know, now that Namath is here, that was the big break, you know, it's getting a national system in place and the government's paying for it. That was a big deal. That was a big deal. And, I'm glad to be a part of it. You know, nobody can take that away, but, just don't be in too much of a rush and just share those stories. The most important thing people can do for us, when I try to put something out and I said, hey, this case is 50 years old, October 17th, you know, we need to think about it. Share those stories. That's what we need. If you think there ought to be a law, then ask your lawmakers, shouldn't there be a law? Mm-hmm. That's the most important things that the public could do for us now. It really is to keep the stories alive and to tell your lawmakers we can do better.
Awesome. Well, Todd, it was an honor to be able to have this conversation with you. I'm glad this happened. And yeah, and I'm always, always looking forward to hearing like more of your successes over at Namath and just the success of Namath and the Doe Network in general. And to me, you'll always be the founding father of this movement. So I
appreciate that.
So I want to thank you,
Todd. I'm a stepfather.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Well, but once again, it's been an honor. Thank you so much for agreeing to have this interview with me. And we hope to hear from you again one day soon.
All right. Well, Godspeed to everybody.
Thank you so much.